science, public interest science, is supposed to help protect or sustain values that the public holds. It's not the place of science to say to the public, there's a scientific case that you should hold this value.
Hello and welcome to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and the Rabble Podcast Network. On today's show, we are going to feature a conversation with Scott Finley, who is one of the co-founders of Evidence for Democracy. He's also a biologist at the University of Ottawa. Scott was in Halifax this week to give a lecture as part of the Situating Science series. He's talking about the need for evidence-based decision-making in Canadian society. So he's making a case for that. I really enjoyed my conversation with Scott. He actually taught me a lot, and I hope you enjoy it too. And then later in the hour, we're going to feature the third in the series of Energy Week features produced at CHUO in Ottawa. So that's the hour before you. I hope you enjoy it. Stay tuned. Scott Finley is co-founder of Evidence for Democracy and an associate professor of biology at the University of Ottawa. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
In your career, you've focused a lot on how science impacts how we make decisions as a society, from our politics to our courtrooms. Beyond what's being described as the current assault on science in Canada, I wonder if you could give us a sense of the broader view. How bad are we at using scientific evidence to inform our decisions?
I'm not sure that bad is really enters into it, because this is an example of what David Hume called an ought type of question. So this is a question having to do with what ought we to do. How ought we to use science? Should we even use science to inform decision making? And this will come as no overwhelming surprise, my idea as a scientist is that, yeah, it's probably a good idea to have decisions informed by science, primarily because decisions that are informed by scientific evidence are more likely to be better decisions. The issue about how we make decisions, how we ought to make decisions, and those are two different things. How we ought to and how we actually do are two completely different things. You know, this has exercised academics for centuries and others for centuries. And I'm not sure that there's even an answer or resolution to the problem. All I can say is, from my personal perspective as a scientist, using scientific evidence to inform decisions is probably a good idea.
All right.
Let me be clear. That's not to say that decision-making is a quintessentially human enterprise. And the minute you talk about humans being involved in the mix somehow, there are other issues besides science that enter into it. Whether they ought to enter into it doesn't matter. They do. That's the facts of life.
I guess most decisions are going to involve some sort of value that's a personal, it could be a personal value or any kind of some sort of arbitrary value that, although we might be informed by science, a lot of decisions that we end up having to make, they come from a different place, I suppose.
Well, I think we have to be careful about, there is this supposed dichotomy between facts and values, but sometimes it's a bit gray, but we should not infer from that, whether that dichotomization is actually an accurate reflection of the way the world is, that's not to say that issues of value don't come into science. And this is a misconception on the part of the public, and it's a misconception on the part of a lot of scientists, in fact. Mm-hmm. Science is riven with all sorts of values. And the failure to recognize those as best we can is got us into some sticky situations in the past as scientists. So facts and values are important. They are horses of a somewhat different color, but this is not to say that science is the exclusive purview, has exclusive purview for facts, there's a bunch of value stuff that happens in science too.
I once read a scientist, Ursula Franklin, talk about how it's very important what you can rely on science to provide you, you know, solid evidence of things or reliable evidence sometimes. But one of the key things you have to remember is it depends what question you're asking.
Of course. Mm-hmm. And it depends on a lot of things. One of the questions is, well, science, public interest science, is supposed to help protect or sustain values that the public holds. It's not the place of science to say to the public, there's a scientific case that you should hold this value. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, whether you believe that it's important that we protect the environment or we don't have to worry about the environment because all we need to do is worry about the economy or the health of your mind or the health of your body, that's a personal decision. Collectively as a society, we have to come up with that. But there's a bunch of those kinds of things that science simply can't inform. And there's a misconception on the part of many, many people that science-based government decision-making, like regulations, mm-hmm. are really just about science. Well, they're not. Let me give you an example, which many, many people find surprising. In Canada, regulation of pesticides, the sale of pesticides, is regulated federally by something called the Pest Control Products Act. The Pest Control Products Act lays out the conditions under which the minister will approve for sale a particular pesticide. One of the conditions, the criteria, is that it poses no unacceptable risk to human health or the environment. Now think about that as a criterion. Acceptability. What science in the world can tell you what's acceptable and what's not? We may be able to tell you what the risks are to human health or the environment, but as to whether those risks are acceptable, well, science can't say anything about that. You know, this is a value issue, and there's a whole bunch of things implicated that. Acceptable to whom? Who bears the cost of that risk, of changing that acceptable risk threshold? You know, your acceptable risk threshold may differ from mine. In fact, my own acceptable risk threshold can vary dramatically. You know, if I have, which I do, 3 children to put through university, and I happen to inherit a, you know, my great aunt Martha dies and leaves me a legacy of some money, I'm going to put it into some safe investment because otherwise my poor children won't be going to university. But suppose I've already paid for my, I wish that I'd already paid for my children to go through university and Aunt Martha dies and leaves me. Well, now I'm going to think, maybe I'll put it into something that's more volatile. My risk threshold, acceptable risk threshold, has changed.
In the example you get in the Pest Control
Products Act,
where does it lie? Who is left with that decision? Do we know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we know quite well because I know people that are in the business of doing this. They work for Health Canada and they work in regulatory affairs to try and do the best job. And they're competent, very good people trying to do the absolute best job they can. But they, of course, struggle with this. And there has to be some way of coming up with a decision. You have to be able to tell Company X that, yeah, you can sell your pesticide here in Canada or you can't. At the end of the day, somebody's got to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And you can find out how that process works. And you can also find out whether it's a process that you necessarily agree with. But at the end of the day, somebody's got to make a decision. And that decision will be based as much upon the science as it is on other things. And I go back to the original point that I made that even the science is not pure science. There's a whole bunch of value stuff in the science itself.
Mm-hmm. Right. You are a co-founder of Evidence for Democracy. Tell us a bit about that organization and I mean, maybe start off with why did you feel the need to create it?
That's a very good question. after the Death of Evidence rally in July of 2012, we, and by we I mean primarily Katie Gibbs, who is my co-founder and the executive director of Evidence for Democracy, and I spent a fair bit of time going around to various institutions to try and figure out sort of what to do next. After the success of that rally, we were besieged by calls from people saying, that was great, now what are you doing? Now what are we doing? And kind of sitting around going, oh, yeah. And I, in particular, was sitting around saying, you know, I do have a regular job and, you know, I only got so much time to spend on this. And so, anyway, to make a long story short, we went around and talked to a bunch of organizations who play in the kind of science, politics, broadly construed sandbox. And we came to the realization that there wasn't an organization that was explicitly devoted to public interest science advocacy, and more particularly to evidence-informed decision-making by government. And that was the origin of the organization. We, Katie and I, thought fundamentally that the public interest file and the evidence file were intrinsically, inextricably linked to the notion of democracy, and hence the name.
Hmm. The rallies that have been happening and the fact that so many scientists have been protesting and people are taking note of this. It's sort of a, it hasn't, it, you know, I don't know if it has ever happened in the history of Canada, but it's certainly, it's a new thing in the last little while, and it's something worth taking note of. But one of the concerns that's been identified is, and you've mentioned it today, the reduction in funding for public interest science. Give us some examples of this reduction in funding. I mean, I know there might be too many to name, but give us a bit of an idea of what we're talking about when we see this sort of shrinking public science. And also, let's talk a little bit about what we mean by public interest science, as opposed to just stuff that can happen, privately or funded by various different means.
Well, okay, let me take the second part of that question first. Okay. Public interest science is science that speaks, you know, directly to values that the public holds. Healthy bodies, healthy minds, healthy environments, healthy economies. I mean, those are kind of the areas, the values, broadly construed, that the public holds. And the science, be it the physical sciences, the biomedical sciences, the natural sciences, the social science, that provides evidence that could be used by governments through policy, statute, regulations to enhance or sustain those values, that's what I would characterize as public interest science in the public interest. And, you know, I've heard this argument before. Well, look, if it's so important, why doesn't business do it? Why don't you let business do the science? Like, let's outsource it to business. And I kind of think, okay, business, the corporation, has a fiduciary responsibility to the corporation. It has no fiduciary responsibility to the public. Mm-hmm. And so you can't have the corporation charged with doing science in the public interest.
Yeah. It has a legal responsibility that sometimes conflicts with the public interest.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. Then you say, okay, I kind of buy the argument that maybe we shouldn't be outsourcing it to business. And by the way, there might be a whole bunch of science that's really important for the protection and sustaining of values that the public holds, but it's hard to make money on now, mm-hmm. So that won't get done. Well, okay, let's let the academics do it. I mean, they're public servants too. The government doesn't have to do it. Well, there's a problem there too, because academic science is in the business of knowledge generation. That's its fiduciary responsibility. Government science, its responsibility, first and foremost, is to produce the evidence required to inform policy, laws, regulation that protect and sustain those public values. And a bunch of that type of science requires, for example, surveillance and monitoring, long-term systematic surveillance and monitoring, often in partnership with other government institutions, provinces, territories, First Nations. Only governments have the kind of infrastructure that you need in order to do that kind of science, and only governments have the fiduciary responsibility. So you can't, there's a bunch of that science that you can't outsource to the private sector, and you can't outsource it to academe, but it's hugely important for the public. That's why you need a robust, healthy government science enterprise.
Hmm. Yeah, it was interesting what you're saying about like academic science, not to disrespect any academic scientists who probably have, you know, ambitions far beyond even what academia demands of them. But like they are responsible for, I guess, just to get at the point you said, creating knowledge is what they're responsible. So there's a pressure for them to be looking at something new, doing something that hasn't been seen before, not necessarily maybe doing what's required just to track what's happening in a lake in inland Nova Scotia somewhere to see, you know, what species of fish are there or something. Something that's maybe, I don't know, has less importance or is not viewed as sort of new information or that advancing humankind kind of stuff. Is that what you mean by that?
Let's be clear. Every scientist thinks that the work that she does is advancing humanity in some way, shape, or form. You know, we like to think that. Yeah. We like to think that it's important to accrue knowledge about the world in which we live. I think that that's true. And it's not that there are types of science that are, I'm talking about basic science here, that are more important than others. It's just that governments often are better equipped, and also they have responsibilities, fiduciary, statutory, regulatory responsibility to do those types of science. Academics may do that type of science, which may be helpful, but that's not where their responsibility. That's not their primary responsibility. They don't have a statute telling them, you must do this. You mm-hmm. must regulate pesticides. So that's the difference. On the novelty thing, this is an interesting point because, and this has come out, I don't know whether you saw a couple months ago, the front page or the front lead article in The Economist about concerns about the state of science and scientific knowledge. And it was pointed out in that article, and there's been a fair amount of work done in this in the last couple of years, about the failure to reproduce historical scientific results. And this is an issue. You know, science is cumulative. It builds on, you have to have a solid foundation because every layer you lay on top. So you want to make pretty sure that every story you put up is pretty solid. And unfortunately, perhaps even distressingly, we tend not to go back to studies that have been already done because in some sense they're not novel. And the problem with that is if you don't, and science knows this, it's all about replication. So you kind of have to do things multiple times just to make sure you're not being led astray. This is not to say that people are making stuff up or anything, but it's just that the natural world is pretty complex out there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to kind of make sure we got these things nailed down, and particularly in things where you're talking about big issues, big scope, long time scales, big space, you know, global issues. Well, it's one thing to play around in a lab, and it's another thing to actually go out there in the wide world or have implications to what's going out there all out there in the wide world. And so I think we do, as science as a community, does have to think seriously about the extent to which it revisits established science, just to make sure that it's as established as we think.
In this discussion that's going on, you know, in the media these days, I hear the term basic research a lot. Forgive my ignorance, but can you explain a bit about what is meant when people use the term that we're losing funding for basic research? What is the what does that term mean? Like, what kind of research are we talking about?
Well, okay, there's a couple of answers to that. First of all, I love the quote by Wernher von Braun, you know, the guy who invented the V2 rocket, who said, and I'm not sure I have the quote exactly, but basic research is what I'm doing when I don't know what I'm doing. And it's basic research is also been characterized as kind of curiosity-driven research. You're just trying to figure out how stuff works. And research, scientific research, is kind of this complex collection of pathways, very convoluted, often kind of bending back on itself. But you got to start somewhere. That's the wellspring of ideas, basic curiosity research. And from there, there's this kind of tangled set of pathways, some of which end up at sort of the commercialization technology end. And the thing that people have to understand is you can't get stuff at the end of the pipe unless you've got the wellspring there. It may be convoluted and it may turn back on itself, and it's, you know, it's not a simple linear pipeline. But the bottom line is you got to have that basic stuff. The laser. The origins of the laser date back to 1917, work by Albert Einstein, who was not in the slightest bit concerned about lasers or anything else. He was just kind of trying to figure out how things worked. 50 years later, we have the first working laser. That process is a lengthy process. And now, of course, the laser technology is everywhere. It's pervasive. It's ubiquitous. So it's difficult to predict where, you know, what's going to come out of basic research. But nobody thinks that you don't need it. Of course you need it. Otherwise, you don't get anything out at the end of the pipe. The issue is the balance. You've got finite resources to invest in science. So where's the sweet spot? Where's the best allocation of resources to basic research and all the way along to commercialization of technologies and so-called innovation, technological innovation at the end of the pipeline? And I'm not sure we know where. In fact, I know we don't know where that sweet spot is. But I think it's very important that we have a discussion and we try and make sure that, you know, we do the best job of making sure that that investment is appropriate all the way along that very kind of complex science R&D ecosystem.
That's Scott Finley, co-founder of Evidence for Democracy and an associate professor of biology at the University of Ottawa. We'll be right back with more from Scott after this.
To be honest with hateful eyes.
That's the Just Barely's with Lions from their album Mad Bits. Coming up next, we have the second part of my conversation with Scott Finley, who is a co-founder of an organization called Evidence for Democracy. He's also an associate professor at the University of Ottawa. We continue the conversation. Scott gives examples of how sometimes, we spin things so that it sounds like we are presenting evidence when in fact we're not. Scott makes a case for citizens to think more like scientists. Here's Scott. Another concern is that's prevalent right now is increasing restrictions on communication for federally funded scientists. I've heard of plenty of stories of scientists being told not to take media calls. I've heard from journalists saying how frustrating it can be. Mm-hmm. But you've also pointed out that there are restrictions in communications even between scientists. How extensive is the communications problem with federal scientists right now?
Well, it's interesting you ask that because one of the projects that E4D is currently working on is exactly that, is we're trying to do a systematic analysis of communication policies, science, and more general communication policies by federal departments and agencies within the federal government, just to try and get a handle on, to do kind of a systematic analysis rather than this anecdotal type of analysis. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there are some things that I have seen which suggest that some of these policies that are now in place do restrict the ability of scientists to communicate amongst themselves in the formats that they usually do communicate. And this is problematic. My colleague Jeff Hutchings, I think, said it here at the Dow, said it best. He said, if you impede the communication of science, you impede science itself. That's absolutely true. Science is a Freemasonry of intellectual ideas, and if you don't allow that communication to happen, you got a problem. Then there's the communication with the public. If you're not communicating that science in an unfiltered form to the public, how can the public possibly make an informed decision? It can't.
Can you give an example of decisions that are being made without the benefit of evidence? Without the benefit of scientific information?
Well, let me take a couple of examples. One that I'm familiar with that's not in the natural and physical sciences is the issue of the safe injection site called InSight in Vancouver. In order to operate a safe injection site, you need to have a dispensation from the minister, because drugs are regulated and they're right, so you have to get an exception. And in 2008, the minister indicated, which was Mr. Clement, I think, at the time, indicated that he was not going to provide them with an exemption. And as a result of that, perhaps inevitably, a case was brought arguing that this infringed the clients of InSight's charter rights. And to make a long story comparatively short, it went through, the trial judge found in favor of the plaintiffs and said, okay, you can have an exemption, and it was appealed by the Attorney General, and it went up the line and eventually ended up in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, considered this issue of the exemption. One of the arguments that had been made by the government was that safe injection sites contributed to prolonging addiction and had a negative impact on the public health. And the Supreme Court, in its decision, was completely unconvinced about this, because no such evidence was adduced, and in fact, there was plenty of evidence to the contrary. This is an example of you know, an argument that was put forward, which was supposedly a scientific argument, but for which the science was virtually non-existent. That's one of a number of examples where you have a decision being taken which seems to fly in the face of the scientific evidence or, you know, the weight of scientific evidence. And I guess because I understand decision-making, we've already talked about this, is, you know, quintessentially a human enterprise. And so a bunch of non-scientific or unscientific issues are going to enter into the equation. I guess that's, you know, a member in reasonably good standing of the human race, I don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is that it's represented otherwise. So if somebody said to me, you know what, we don't want to have safe injection sites, not because that they're necessarily, you know, prolonging the addiction periods for clients or they're affecting public health or anything else, but because we just ideologically, we just don't like the idea of allowing people, you know, legally to inject drugs. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, I'm okay with that because at least you've told us the reason, and then the public can decide. You know, you've appropriately represented the situation, and if the public decides, okay, that's fine. You know, we don't worry about the scientific evidence, and I think, well, okay. Why not? But if the scientific evidence is being misrepresented, the nature of that evidence is being misrepresented, either implicitly or explicitly, then I have a real problem with it. Mm-hmm. And you see this kind of thing all the time. Let me give you a simple, simple example. If I say to you, there's no evidence that fracking has any significant human health impacts. Now, there's two ways that sentence can be interpreted. One is, we've never even looked. Mm-hmm. So the other side of the coin is, there's no evidence that it doesn't either. A second way to interpret that sentence is, well, actually, we've done an enormous amount of work, and we've not been able to find any evidence of any significant, or indeed any, human health impact associated with fracking. Now, each of those two interpretations is perfectly consistent with that sentence, but the implications are completely different. Mm-hmm. Evidence of absence is not absence of evidence, nor vice versa. And so this is an example where you have not kind of the necessarily the deliberate misrepresentation, and I'm not talking about fracking specifically, mm-hmm. I'm just taking that as an example, where the message, the evidentiary message, can get manipulated. Mm-hmm. I want the public to think like a scientist. And in fact, we are. We all are scientists. That's what being Homo sapiens thinking man is all about, right? And I want people to embrace their inner scientists, and I want them to think, right, when somebody says to me, there is no evidence that, what exactly does that mean? I want to ask the question. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell me, hold on a second. Does that mean nobody's looked? Or does that mean you got, you know, mountains of evidence and you never found anything? Can you tell me which of those it is? That's what I want people to do. Mm-hmm. And we can all do it. We have the intellectual wherewithal to do it. It's not that difficult. We're all of us practicing scientists, whether we know it or not, not by vocation, but by attitude.
In this radio show, often we come up upon issues where it does seem that there is not an agreement on basic facts of a situation. Like, what are the effects of a large aquaculture farm off the coast of, you know, Nova Scotia? What is happening? Like, it, quite often it comes down to, you know, when I hear, you know, if I'm talking to someone from the aquaculture industry, or if I'm talking to someone who lives on the Eastern Shore who doesn't want to see a farm off there, it really does sound like I'm getting, like, totally different stories. And not just in terms of what their values are, but just, it just seems like, you know, there needs to be a mediator to bring everyone together often and just say, we're going to need to get in a room together and agree on, you know, the pro-fracking people and the anti-fracking people. Can we just like, can we sit down and decide what the sentence is that we're going to use from now on? Is it that there is no evidence, and do we mean that we've looked for it but we couldn't find it, or do we mean that we haven't looked yet? You know, I mean, it's a huge problem.
It is, and it's interesting you bring this up, because this is exactly the rationale for a project that I've been involved in for the last 3 years, which was to produce a manual for Canada's judiciary on how to interpret scientific evidence in the courtroom. Because what drives judges nuts is the dueling scientists, the he says, the she says.
And in a courtroom, it's totally opposite.
Well, it's adversarial. It's adversarial, of course. So you're going to get dueling scientists.
Right.
But the whole idea here was to try and produce a resource that would allow judges to kind of parse through this expert scientific testimony to see, you know, is it a real conflict or is it only apparent conflict? If it is a conflict, well, is there different weight associated with these? Because not all science is created equal. In the parlance of science, not every scientific experiment has the same inferential strength. And so superficially, study A might be saying one and study two, B might be saying not one. But if you look at their inferential strength, well, maybe one is hugely, has much higher inferential strength than the other. And so the idea was to create some sort of a resource that would allow judges, who almost invariably are not scientists, but they're very bright people, to kind of resolve this dueling scientist stuff. And the tools that are in the manual, they're the same kind of tools that you could use. There's nothing exalted about them. You can use those same tools. You bring up this point of getting everybody together. Well, increasingly, for expert scientific witnesses, there's this phenomenon called hot tubbing of experts. So the judge will say, basically, right, guys and girls.
They don't use real hot tubs, though.
No, please. No, okay. But that's the idea is, you know, the metaphor is you get your dueling scientific experts in the hot tub, and it's a nice relaxed environment. It's not adversarial, yeah. And they kind of sort out amongst themselves, you know, okay, here's the things that we agree on, here's the things that we don't agree on. So when you get back in the courtroom, you have a much more efficient process, so you don't have, you know, all the stuff that the experts seem to agree on or have come to agree upon by virtue of this hot tubbing exercise gets put aside, and you can concentrate on the, in legal parlance, the res. Well, you know, maybe that's what we need for these hugely contentious issues. Mm-hmm. But my experience is, and the judges, I think, are a perfect example. I mean, their ability to pick this stuff up, because it's not that really that difficult. Anybody can do it, and they can become much better judges in pretty short order just by thinking about a couple of pretty basic principles. And I believe that virtually anybody in the public space can do that. They just need to be sensitized that they need to do it. You know, if I say to you, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, if you think about it, you say, oh, of course that must be the case. If you don't have the habit of doing that, then it seems all superficially plausible and you just kind of let it slide.
Let's talk a bit about solutions. You mentioned therapeutic and preventative interventions.
Yeah.
What are you suggesting?
Well, I just talked about one. I mean, this to me is the most important intervention, and it's both therapeutic and it's preventative, right? If the public becomes more skeptical, and by the way, I mean, I don't mean skeptical in a pejorative sense. I mean, in a positive sense. This is, you know, constructively skeptical, to really to think about things like a scientist would. And also, by the way, I mean skeptical about the science, because that's one of the things that perhaps scientists have not been as good at as they should be, is to be skeptical about their own science. But to me, that's sort of a measure. If we can raise the level of constructive skepticism in the public, even just a little bit, I think the effects will be profound. You know, if if it becomes a kind of a Pavlovian knee-jerk reaction, when somebody stands up in a public space and says, you know, here's our objective. We want to increase voter turnout. And the way we're going to do this is to have a piece of legislation that, you know, empowers Election Canada to tell people where and when and how to vote, but doesn't allow them to advertise to just get out the vote. And somebody might say, so you think the major reason that you've got declining engagement of the Canadian public in voting is because they don't know where to vote? You think that's going to solve, what's the evidence that that's going to solve the problem? Maybe, just maybe, it's because many Canadians feel disengaged or disconnected or disenfranchised. Maybe that's why they're not voting. And telling them where to vote or how to vote is going to do nothing, right? So when I talk about, you know, I was a bit glib there about therapeutic and preventative measures, but that to me, this raising the public consciousness about, you know, just to be a little bit more critical, I think that will have both effects.
Yeah. And I guess that's leading to the ultimate thing was if, you know, raising this level of constructive skepticism in the public is going to lead to a public that's, you know, feels better informed to, I guess, draw the line on where our political leadership takes us. And if, I mean, I guess in terms of, you know, if we do have a direction that we're headed, if the federal government has a direction that they're headed with how they resource and respect government science, I mean, in terms of a prevention or a solution for that, I mean, basically we're talking, we just need a public who are able to stand up and say, this is not making sense right now.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, to me, when you talk about, you know, basic principles of democracy, what is it? Transparency and accountability, right? And I believe that particularly on the accountability file, this is hugely important. If you have that attitude, that kind of the scientific attitude of, wait a second, you tell me this, what's the evidence? Then the accountability bar height takes a quantum jump up, right? Saying it so is not good enough. You have to have your case. You got to make your case to a critical audience. And if you can't, we don't want to listen to you. And that to me is an important goal, and it's an achievable goal. Whatever else evidence for democracy does, that's what I would like it to achieve.
Well, we wish you luck with that.
Yeah.
Well, we all have
Canvas. Right.
Well, I guess ultimately we all have our responsibility. So we all need to make an effort.
Yeah.
Well, Scott Finley, thanks for speaking with me today.
You're more than welcome. It's my pleasure.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
Of the awesome machinery of nature. I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky.
But the brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, it synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions.
The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
For thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, our image of the universe today is full of strange-sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
Shore of the cosmic ocean. Recently we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.
That was A Glorious Dawn, part of Symphony of Science, a music project created by Washington-based electronic musician John Boswell. You may have seen it on YouTube. It's a pretty popular video. He pieces together video and audio clips from popular science TV shows. So that was Carl Sagan and I believe Stephen Hawking that you heard. You're tuned to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and the Rabble Podcast Network. We're winding down this week's episode of Habitat. Hope you enjoyed it. One more feature before we go. I'll leave you with a third installment of the Energy Week series produced by CHUO in Ottawa.
You're listening to Talk Energy, where we hear from Canadians across the country, talk with a variety of energy experts, and explore lessons from Canada's energy history. Our mission? To find out what it means to understand energy and why understanding energy is so important for Canadians. My name is Ophira Horowitz, and I want to know, are you ready to talk energy?
On a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is not important and 10 is super important, how important is energy to you and why?
I would say 10. Energy is extremely important to me. I actually don't know how I would survive without it, so that's a really difficult one to live without.
I would say probably about 8, because even though in my day-to-day it's so necessary, I also really enjoy taking breaks from it and getting out in nature and camping and all that kind of stuff.
I think it should be an 8 for me, but in reality it's probably a 5. I don't think about it very much. I just sort of bask in the glory of a lifestyle supplied by energy.
If you could ask an energy expert anything, totally on the spot, what would it be?
I would ask an energy expert to describe what energy is in many various forms.
If I could ask anything, it would be, why does it matter that life has to move in such a way that we need to keep consuming more and more energy? Isn't it possible that life could be better if we consumed a lot less?
What kinds of things have you done to save on energy? Are you willing to make changes to your lifestyle?
I am always willing to make changes to my lifestyle. I personally stopped traveling as much as I did.
I've thought about making all kinds of changes, but haven't really done that much. I've unplugged my coffee maker when I go out of town.
The only big changes I've made are, you know, the light bulbs. I did notice a lot of times I turn on the TV and use my laptop at the same time. I've stopped doing that. I either do one or the other rather than both.
We just heard views from everyday Canadians across Canada on energy. Now we turn to some of the experts for their take on energy literacy. We're talking energy with Peter Bogue, the president and CEO of the Canadian Fuels Association, the organization that represents the industry that supplies 95% of Canada's transportation fuels. Now, Peter, before we start, would you like to comment on some of the responses you just heard?
So I'm actually quite encouraged by the general recognition of the importance of energy in our daily lives shown in those interviews. Energy really is a fundamental enabler of our way of life and standard of living. I mean, the recognition is not necessarily at the same level in all of those responses, but overall it is encouraging. I think the second point is the dichotomy between an expressed desire to reduce energy consumption in a meaningful way and how to actually do that without negative impacts on our lifestyle expectations. It did really put the focus on the impact of individual and societal choices and behavior, on energy demand and energy consumption.
What does energy literacy mean to you?
Well, I think on the issue of energy literacy, I see kind of three components. The first component is really a good understanding of the pervasive role that energy plays in our economy and in our daily lives. I think the second component would be a basic, and I'm not talking about detailed knowledge and detailed understanding, but definitely a basic ability to connect the dots between our energy use, and that's whether it's flipping the light switch, it's putting the thermostat up on the furnace in the morning, or filling at the pump. So connecting that with the complexity of the system, that delivers these energy services to us 24/7, where it comes from and how it gets to us. And I guess, and too many Canadians, I think, really don't think about that or either take it for granted. And the third component of energy literacy for me is understanding the role that our own individual choices and behaviors have on overall energy demand and consumption in the country.
That's actually an excellent segue to my next question. Why is it so important that Canadians learn about energy?
Well, I think it really comes back to that pervasive role that was spoken to in those early responses, and that role we play as individuals, that role we as individuals play in consumption and demand. Energy is connected to everything we do in life, and there are consequences for our energy use. Consequences about energy supply, consequences for the energy infrastructure we need to ensure reliable supply, and consequences, for the environment. I think these are all key elements of why it's important.
Now, what's one thing about energy, if I were to walk away from this interview, what's one thing about energy every Canadian needs to know?
I guess if I had to boil it down to one thing, it would be the role that we as individuals play in energy demand and consumption, and ultimately how that impacts, the nature of the energy system. And that includes the impacts of the energy system, and those impacts can be environmental impacts. They can be infrastructure impacts. So, all energy consumption ultimately, has implications for the environment and the system that delivers energy.
Now, Peter, I have one more question for you. What do you think are the biggest obstacles to energy literacy, and how can we overcome them?
I think it's complicated. This is not a simple subject, energy. People like simple answers, I guess, and so it's hard to really move them forward in terms of their knowledge and understanding and literacy of what is a very complex subject. And when it comes to issues around, their use of energy and environmental impacts, I think often people want to see, well, that's somebody else's problem. Oh, that's not mine. And I think part of that, again, related to that as an obstacle, is they don't necessarily want to hear that through their own consumption decisions, they're part of the environmental challenges of energy consumption. So I think those were, some of the key obstacles.
Peter, thank you. We've just heard from an energy expert. Now let's learn some lessons from our energy history. We're speaking with Brian DeWalt, the Curator of Communications at the Canada Science and Technology Museums Corporation. He's published on the history of printing technology, dictation machines, and digital networks, but today he'll be discussing a subject that is close to my heart, radio and cell phones. Brian, take it away.
Many people don't realize, but our mobile phones are actually radios. They're two-way radios that we carry around in our pockets and our purses. And they represent really the culmination of 100 years of innovation in radio technology. A lot of that innovation was aimed at making radio devices more energy efficient. The mobile phone, like any other radio device, is both a transmitter and a receiver. And at the transmitter end, you have to essentially create a disturbance in the electromagnetic spectrum by inputting electrical current to a antenna, and then that disturbance travels through space as a radio wave and is picked up by a receiver. And you need energy both at the input and the output, and essentially you're trying to reduce the power input by making the antenna more efficient in how it radiates the energy, and also you're trying to reduce the frequency spectrum, and you're spreading that energy over. So you want to be more efficient there. And then with the receiver, it's a matter of reducing the amount of electrical input to amplify the signal so you can hear it. So with a mobile phone, one of the ways that it's done to make it more efficient is to create a network of these zones called cells, where you have a tower. And to call from downtown Ottawa to Kanata, rather than call all the way using radio waves, you only call to a nearby tower by radio, and then your signal is relayed by phone lines to Kanata, where it's then sent again a short distance by radio to the person receiving your call. That's a far more low power way to send a signal, and therefore you don't need a massive battery in your pocket in order to do that. And so that is one of the most important innovations with cellular phones or mobile phones.
Thank you.
This program was brought to you by Let's Talk Energy, an initiative of the Canada Science and Technology Museums Corporation, in partnership with your local community radio station. This segment was co-produced by Let's Talk Energy and CHUO 89.1 FM. Thank you to CHUO in Ottawa, CJSR in Edmonton, and CKDU in Halifax for providing interviews with Canadians from across the country. Special thanks to host Afira Horwitz and sound editor Adriana White.
You've been listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and ravel.ca/podcasts. Got feedback on the show? Call the CKDU feedback line at 494-8041 or email habitat@ckdu.ca. Or check us out on Twitter at Habitat Radio. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening. Habitat.